Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Keeping It Cool podcast. This is going to be the final episode in the first season of this podcast. I'm so excited to have worked on this for the past few months, and I think today's guest will really close everything out. So today we have Amy Goble on the podcast. Amy is a senior scientist in emerging technology at Johnson & Johnson Innovative Medicine, where she leads the development of next-generation inspection technologies for injectable pharmaceutical products. She is also the co-founder of the Alliance for Responsible Capitalism, which is a nonprofit focused on aligning corporate political influence with climate-positive activity. Amy's career spans environmental consulting, global supply chain operations, and sustainability leadership, with a consistent focus on leveraging business and policy to drive systemic climate solutions. She holds a BA in geosciences from Princeton University and dual degrees, an MBA and an MS in engineering systems from MIT. Without further ado, here's Amy. Hi, Amy. How are you? Thanks for joining me on the show.
So far, so good. How are you doing?
I'm good. Excited to have you here. Amazing. Well, I'd love to just jump into learning more about you and the Alliance for Responsible Capitalism. So would you be able to share a little bit more about your background and what led you to co-found the Alliance for Responsible Capitalism?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to try to tell it in a way that doesn't go too far back into my childhood, but I think childhood is the place to start. I spent a lot of time with my family in the outdoors, going to national parks. In particular, we visited the Everglades a lot. And it was funny going back year after year, you could see the place degrade, see the challenges getting worse from year to year. And so I feel like I had that connection to, okay, here's a place that I love, and humans are the ones that are causing the challenges to this place. So I think I had that embedded pretty early. For what I wanted to do, my mission, as soon as I was able to articulate a mission, was having a positive impact on the environment. And I was really drawn to looking for win-win opportunities in the business world. So focused on business because that's where the footprint is. So that's where there's potential for scale. And win-win because there is so much low-hanging fruit. So I actually went to business school. I did a dual degree program in business and engineering to do that, to learn what are the business levers for driving sustainability, and then how do I actually put that into action in a supply chain role. But when I actually got into a company, I quickly ran into what are the limits of win-win when you're actually making those day-to-day decisions, when leaders are trying to prioritize, how am I going to spend this incremental dollar or incremental resource? And that got me thinking about, okay, what are the broader incentives that are shaping these decisions, right? How are leaders in a company that is known for sustainability still choosing the short term over the long term? And one of the things that really drove this point home, or drove home the limits of win-win, was around the Inflation Reduction Act. So when this bill was being negotiated, there were $369 billion in funding for moving the United States towards more a sustainable pathway that was being debated. I saw that the company that I'm working for, where I have my day job still, was showing up on a list of companies that were actually blocking that bill, or at least staying silent. And that was a shock, because on the one hand, okay, it's a company with strong sustainability bona fides, but then is maybe getting flagged for being silent, for missing this opportunity to be an advocate on climate policy, on transformative climate policy, or maybe even be involved in keeping that bill from getting passed. So that was this wake-up call for me, that it's not enough just to look at what's happening within a company. You need to look at how that company is influencing the political landscape. And even though I was in the green program in my business school, that wasn't something that was really part of the conversation. So that was the motivation for me and for one of my classmates to co-found the Alliance for Responsible Capitalism, to shine a spotlight on the importance of that and to bring the awareness of the political influence around sustainability into business education.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's a really clear narrative that kind of shows each decision that you made and why it was the right choice for you. I feel like just when you read about the Alliance for Responsible Capitalism, sometimes I feel like it's not 100% clear why you brought all of these things together, but really articulating it in that way, it really makes a lot of sense. So I'm hoping you can just introduce the Alliance for Responsible Capitalism and its mission more clearly here.
Absolutely. So with that background and with that motivation, our mission is to align corporate political influence with sound climate policy. We see this as a problem, that we need effective climate policy to take action against climate at the speed and scale required, and corporations are one of the main reasons we haven't been able to implement effective climate policy. And yet there's a clear cost, a clear risk to the business sector if we don't take enough action on climate change. One of the climate models that I love using, the En-ROADS climate simulation model that I first got exposed to at MIT, where I did my business program, projects out what are the costs of the status quo. And if we continue on our current trajectory, by the end of the century, we can expect annual damage due to climate change to exceed the size of the global economy today. So there's real urgency, right, for the business sector to solve this problem. And we want the political influence to be aligned with.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think sometimes it's kind of difficult to paint that picture, but I like that model too. And if somebody listening hasn't heard of it, you should definitely check it out. I'll put it in the show notes. And I know you talked about this a little bit already, but maybe we can dive a little bit deeper on what motivated you to focus on corporate political influence as a key driver of climate action, just kind of understanding some of the groundwork that went into that.
Of course. So to throw in a bit of carbon accounting jargon. I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with scope 1, 2, and 3 from the Greenhouse Gas Accounting Protocol. Scope 1 is what you emit directly. Scope 2 is emissions related to purchased utilities. And 3 is everything else in supply chain, upstream from materials, downstream for transportation and end of life. And one of the key insights from looking into that accounting is that scope 3 is often an order of magnitude larger than scope 1 and 2. What you do in your broader supply chain is much bigger than necessarily what's happening in the four walls of your operations. Now, take that one step further. If you're thinking about your influence as a company, companies are starting to take ownership and accountability for scope 3, but what about the rules that shape behavior of the entire economy? That's the policy landscape. That's the set of regulations and laws that are driving incentives and shaping behavior for all of your suppliers, all of your distributors, all of your customers. And that is, I've seen referred to as scope 4. That's the political influence. How is your company contributing to shaping those rules and regulations that incentivize and create the rules by which everyone plays? One example of how the kind of internal operations focus and the policy focus can really deviate is actually the parent corporation of Fox News, News Corp. This is from a somewhat dated op-ed. I think it was published in 2011, but still very relevant today and resonant with why this is important. The parent company News Corp received the highest ESG rating from MSCI on sustainability because they had achieved carbon neutral operations. So you have a company that is, on the one hand, achieving not emitting any carbon, purchasing 100% renewable electricity, and yet is part of a substantial disinformation ecosystem on climate change that is actually contributing to blocking progress on actually tackling climate. That doesn't make sense, right? So looking just at operations without taking into consideration the full scope of influence, I think is misguided and creates risks for people that are trying to invest or purchase from or work for companies. You need to think about that corporate political influence piece as well.
Yeah. So does the Alliance for Responsible Capitalism kind of help highlight some of these discrepancies? I'm just curious how they, you know, align business with kind of these policies that are internal to companies.
Absolutely. We're a tiny nonprofit. So we are relying a lot on the ecosystem of available information in this space. I think two great resources that I'd call out are Influence Map. They're one of the groups that use that scope for terminology, they track at a very granular level what are companies saying on climate, how are companies lobbying, what sort of press releases are they doing in opposition to how the companies are talking about climate change in necessarily their annual filings. The other good organization that I would like to highlight is this Center for Political Accountability. They are focused on political spending and how that creates risks for companies. Have created some really interesting reports that explicitly say these companies have committed to sustainability goals, and yet they are contributing to helping people get elected who are working directly against climate. So our role is not generating that primary research, but rather helping make the connection between the next generation of business talent and this information. We want it to be part of the business conversation, part of the sustainability conversation in the business community, and making sure that we're putting the spotlight on these risks for companies that are not considering their political influence.
Yeah, you kind of talked about the next generation of business leaders. I know that the Alliance for Responsible Capitalism works a lot with business students in trying to advocate for some of this work that you're doing. So kind of, can you tell me about that choice to engage primarily with students? How do you see that shaping the future of these businesses?
Absolutely. So we have two strategies. We have a short-term strategy that's focused on influencing companies and a longer-term strategy that's focused on influencing universities. On the company side, we, you know, in the business world, you have to simplify everything to 3 points. So we say businesses care about 3 things: having a talent pipeline, their reputation, and their bottom line. So students are able to influence those first 2 items. They are the future of companies. Their voice matters. So when students start to consider corporate political influence around sustainability in their hiring decisions, that can be a really powerful lever for driving change. Even, you know, now it's a tighter job market. It's a tougher ask for students to be putting themselves on the line, but there's still an opportunity. Companies still compete for top talent. Companies are still fighting over those most attractive students that are going to be generating value. So it is still a powerful lever, even when the hiring space gets tighter. The longer-term strategy focused on universities is based on the idea that the assumptions, the norms of business behavior very much get shaped by business schools. And at least from my experience, we're still very much rooted in the Milton Friedman shareholder primacy approach. That's the implicit assumption that undergirds so much of business education. We need to switch that because it's clear the current setup is not working. There's increasing disillusionment with the economic system, with the political system behind it. And this is a different approach, something focused on not just the narrow profit optimization, but the broader responsibility of companies to be positive contributors to this broader system that we're all operating in. And students are the customers for universities. I've heard time and time again that the way to change curricula is through the student voice. That's the thing that they care about. And alumni are also a critical player here because the alumni are the pipeline of donations and future buildings for universities. But being part of that student and alumni ecosystem is very powerful and influential for getting business schools to then do the hard work of adapting curricula to incorporate these ideas.
That makes a lot of sense. I think that's a good approach. And I know that a lot of my peers and myself included are definitely motivated on this issue. So I think for a lot of these things that are trying to, you know, make businesses or even universities take action, the students are a good driver for that. So I know we've talked about this a little, but I was wondering if you have specific examples on some of the biggest challenges that companies face when they're trying to match their corporate influence and sustainability goals. I know you mentioned some examples of mismatch, but what do you think are the underlying challenges here?
Of course, I'll highlight research done by Amy Meyer and Elliot Metzger from the World Resources Institute that looked at exactly this. They captured 7 barriers to U.S. leadership by the corporate sector on climate policy. This was published,
think in 2017, but still very relevant today. It's a lot of different seven different factors, but things like it's very difficult to have an informed decision on sustainability policy. Are the people in your government affairs organization also plugged in on sustainability policy, which is an entirely different space than maybe tax policy, intellectual property rights, the types of things that they probably are focused on more of the time? Or competing priorities. What's the short-term need of a company? What's the long-term need of a company? That's something that came up a lot during the debates around the Inflation Reduction Act. One of the ways to pay for that substantial investment in sustainable development was increasing the corporate tax rate. And of course, how is a company going to be approaching that? Yes, we want action on climate, but no, we don't want to be the ones paying for it. So how do you find the right way of balancing those competing priorities? And something that's probably overlooked in a lot of business schools as the role of trade associations in this space. So most companies are members of organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce or the Business Roundtable, or more industry-specific associations like the National Association of Manufacturers. And companies pay substantial amounts of money to these trade associations so that the trade associations represent their interests in the policy space. But a lot of the time, those trade associations end up going for kind of a lowest common denominator approach so that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, for example, is basically representing the interests of the fossil fuel sector. And yet they're getting funding from the tech companies, the healthcare companies, the banks, all of the companies that are trying to position themselves as more sustainable, but end up with effectively their influence counteracting their sustainability goals. And last one I'll mention here is the political landscape. Risk of political backlash is a real fear. Companies have to operate on longer time cycles than elections. And if they take a very strong leadership stance and then the political winds change, that can feel very risky for companies. So thinking about how it's easier just to stay silent or to just go with the status quo rather than trying to be bold and take a leadership position on climate action.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. No, I think there's a ton of challenges in this space. I would really love to hear kind of the actions that you're hoping that companies take, the concrete things you want companies to move toward in the future, and a little bit more about how the Alliance for Responsible Capitalism like puts forward these actions, right? So it's through the students, but how do you actually see that happening in practice?
Absolutely. I've been remiss for not mentioning so far the framework for corporate political responsibility. This is a framework developed by the Erb Institute at the University of Michigan, a group convened called the Corporate Political Responsibility Task Force, pulling in companies that are seeing the challenges in this space to define what are the actions that we should take or what are the principles that we should be holding ourselves to. So our call to action is for companies to adopt these principles and to take action towards actually living them. And there's an organization called Third Side Strategies that spun out of the CPRT, the task force, that is continuing to advance this work and provide more concrete tools for how companies can take that on. But generally, that framework expects companies to be engaging where they have an authentic basis to engage, that they are accountable to their commitments, to their stakeholders, that they have a robust governance around their political influence, that they are engaging in responsible political influence, which means that their efforts in the political landscape are not undermining fundamental systems on which we all depend, such as having a livable planet, as well as having a stable democracy and healthy markets. And then that they are transparent and provide open and honest communication about what they're actually doing in the political land space. That's hard. It's a change, and it requires making trade-offs to actually start living these principles. But that's our call to action, and that's what we're encouraging companies to do. Very specifically, then there are then actions or additional resources that companies can tap. such as the CPA-Zicklin Model Code of Conduct. I mentioned the CPA Center for Political Accountability earlier. There's also the CERES Blueprint for Responsible Policy Engagement for Best Practices Around Lobbying. These are all things that help companies think through what is the scope of our political influence? How are we engaging in lobbying? How are we engaging in political spending? How are we talking to our trade associations about our climate policies? And are these, as we're looking at, you know, those barriers to action, how, as we're looking at those competing priorities and the lack of resources and considering the political landscape that we're in, how do we actually make the right decision? That's what that landscape of tools is available for. We just need companies to do it and to make the first step in considering those priorities. You also ask what we're doing specifically to get companies to start doing that.
What's encouraging them?
We're hoping for two things. On that kind of longer term strategy of influencing universities, we want students to be exposed to these tools and bring those tools and those lessons with them into their roles after they graduate. But in the shorter term, we are working on a scorecard that creates some positive competition among companies. We want companies to be advertising not just their sustainability credentials to attract those students that see climate change as something that they want to tackle in their career, but also competing on their positive political influence. So we're working with a group of volunteers to figure out how do we even assess companies on this, on these dimensions? How do we determine their relative alignment with corporate political responsibility and then create some positive momentum around companies wanting to climb up that ranking on their CPR to be more effective at attracting that top talent?
That makes sense. So it's kind of like a circular thing where you're encouraging and working with students to kind of evaluate these companies and then hoping that companies basically use these metrics because it'll then give them a better talent pipeline, if that kind of summarizes it. Cool. Great. That sounds like a good plan. I know that you and Alliance for Responsible Capitalism helped co-host a program called the ESG Dilemma Design Challenge, which you hosted for students, which explored how financial institutions can navigate political tensions around sustainable finance. I'm curious how that went, if you have any key takeaways from that, and just, yeah, the experience of hosting that.
Yeah, it was a blast. Really valuable to get a diverse group of stakeholders together as our panelists from business, academia, civil society, and then bringing in students with all these fresh ideas for how to tackle this challenge. A couple of key takeaways. One, the most important thing is that the climate risk is real, and that is not going away just because we have an administration that doesn't want climate action to continue. So it's important not to lose ambition despite the headwinds. At the same time, the political risks are real. The costs to a company of having to face a lawsuit, even if it's totally spurious, are real. It can be millions of dollars just to deal with the paperwork. So having an approach to continue to progress climate action that takes into consideration those legal and political risks is very important. We found that the most effective ways, the solutions that really bubbled to the top, were engaging that wide group of stakeholders, using all of your levers for political influence, such as engaging constructively with your trade associations is really important, and that communication is key. You want a consistent message that tries to take as many of the political barbs out of the topic as possible, such as emphasizing that sustainability is, or taking action to mitigate climate risk is the right thing for customers and for the stakeholders, that it is part of your fiduciary duty. That's really important. And the motivation to continue moving forward is to think about how your company will be viewed when looking back in another 10 or 20 years. Maintaining ambition is hard, but it's important to keep an eye on the future.
Yeah, I think that look back is really important too, to consider, especially as, you know, political winds, you know, change over time. And it's easy to get sucked into what's happening now, but thinking about, you know, the longer term prospects, both for your business and like the perception of your business as well, is a nice way to think about that too. So that's super interesting. I know that you mentioned that you're working with students to kind of evaluate how to evaluate these companies, but how do you measure success in shifting corporate lobbying strategies toward climate positive action? How do you know when that's working and when it's not working?
That's one of the fundamental challenges of working in this space. So little disclosure is actually required. So on lobbying, for example, a company is required to disclose that they lobbied on a bill, but they don't need to say whether they were for it or against it. So we rely a lot on transparency, on disclosure by the companies on a voluntary basis, which is why that transparency principle is so important. So we are looking for companies to be more open about what they're doing and be more transparent about how they're achieving alignment.
That makes sense. And then I'm also curious about the role that public pressure plays in influencing corporate climate advocacy. So we've talked a lot about the student perspective, how students become employees at this organization, but what can people do as kind of outside stakeholders?
Yeah. So I think I'm going to reframe from pressure into persuasion. And the reason is, I think no one likes to be on the crossfires of activists, but companies do materiality assessments. Companies consider what is actually material to our stakeholders. And you see companies performing these dual materiality assessments, looking at what's relevant, not just to business, but what are our customers saying that they care about, our investors, our employees, and so on. And I think that there isn't enough focus on the political influence. So it's not showing up in the double materiality assessment by companies. But as soon as we start to engage students in these conversations, they get it, right? The light bulb goes off and says, we see that this is absolutely material to how the company is engaging in the climate space. So the role of public pressure, or this public persuasion, let's say, is helping companies see that this is something that they should be prioritizing, because it is, as I said, it's hard. These decisions are tough. So what are the things that we can bring to bear to encourage companies to make that investment?
Yeah, that makes sense. I like the focus away from pressure and kind of toward advocacy too. I think that's important. And then my final question, you know, you're on this podcast, obviously you want to increase the Alliance for Responsible Capitalism's awareness and perception, particularly at a student level. But are there other actions that your organization is taking to kind of increase their footprint among students? Can you talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, we are a grassroots style organization, so we are dependent a lot on our volunteers. We used a volunteer base to do a lot of the preparation for the ESG Dilemma Design Challenge that you mentioned. We have relied on volunteers to generate a lot of the materials that we are using and building as part of our initiative to bring more focus on corporate political responsibility into the classroom. So we engage our teams to host webinars and events and their university campuses. Fun backstory, you hosted an event for us when we came through in September. We were able to put together a collaboration with Project Drawdown to talk about why, how every job can be a climate job. But when you're thinking about what company to work for, how can you bring in to take into consideration the dimension of corporate political responsibility? So that was fun. And things like the ESG Dilemma Design Challenge, we create these co-curricular events that can catch student interest, fit into the business student's typical experience, but don't have quite the activation hurdle of actually changing the curriculum, to create opportunities for students to learn. And we're going to be doing the design challenge again in this next academic year, and are looking to keep that kind of engagement going.
Amazing. So if you're a student listening, particularly a business student listening, something to keep in mind as well. Great. So what is next? What's next on deck for the Alliance for Responsible Capitalism? How do your next few months look, and maybe year and beyond?
Absolutely. So we are as I mentioned, refreshing the design challenge, looking to bring in some fresh content to make sure that we're reflecting the political situation that we're facing with the second Trump administration. And I mentioned the scorecard already. So we have a student team that's starting to wrap their hands around what are the data sources that are out there? How can we create a scoring methodology that makes sense, that provides insights to both students and to the companies that are getting rated accordingly? And then on the university focus piece, we have working on getting a CPR course launched. We already have much of the content developed in collaboration with the University of Michigan. And now we are in conversation with the Georgetown Business School to try to figure out where we can fit that into their curriculum. We also supported one of our students did an independent study looking at where CPR cases might be dropped into typical business classes. And so let's say if you want to teach CPR in a business strategy class or in an operations class, how do you teach that? What is the right set of teaching materials? And how can you pull in stories from the news so that it stays fresh and relevant? So that's being published through Third Side Strategies and looking for ways that we can build off of that, those materials, and actually launch that into some curricula.
Oh, that's very exciting. I like the idea of kind of integrating it into multiple different classes. I feel like we had some courses at NYU. We had one course in particular that was all focused on that. And I think it definitely would have been better if it had just been spread out among different classes that we had. Amazing. So you kind of mentioned, you know, the changing political landscape. I'm curious about the trends that you see shaping corporate climate advocacy in the coming years, particularly as we continue to navigate the Trump administration.
Yeah, it's a scary time. It's a scary time to be out front as a climate leader because the administration has made it clear that that's not a priority and that they're willing to penalize companies that are not aligned with their priorities. And as I mentioned, those costs are real, which is why we see so many companies stepping back, being silent, pulling out of international associations like the Net Zero Banking Alliance. And that focus on climate advocacy is turning very much internal. The companies that are still trying to advocate and a lot of civil society organizations are shifting their focus from a federal level onto a state level because there still seems like there's a lot of opportunity and potential there. But I think that's okay. It's important. There's a lot of work to be done and all hands on deck and any place you can make a difference matters. But I think there's a risk of completely seeding the ground at the federal level. One of the examples of how organizations can still lead in this space, there was basically a lobbying weekend organized by Ceres that brought 70 companies to Capitol Hill to lobby to maintain funding from the Inflation Reduction Act that was being considered to be cut as part of the budget reconciliation process. And those are companies from across the political spectrum who are saying, wait, actually, we've committed to investing in solar farms. You're working on relocating factories here based on the funding that's currently available. So this is a real business cost to have this sudden change in this political funding. To come back to the question, what are the trends? I predict the pessimistic prediction is more withdrawal, more greenwashing, but the optimistic prediction is that companies can still find these strategic opportunities where it's not just I'm sticking my head out as a climate leader, I'm trying to be in the spotlight on this, but rather making a clear business case that this is something that's important, not because it's green, hippy-dippy, climate-focused, but because it's the right thing to do for our customers, for our employees, for our shareholders.
Yeah, I think some of the previous guests we've had on the podcast have all said kind of different versions of that, that it's going to be a time where people return to fundamentals of what makes good business and kind of the mantra that you've said throughout the podcast too, which is, you know, how the company wants to treat people and how it wants to be looked at in the future. Okay, my last question for you is just especially because you work with students so much, I'm curious your perspective on advice you would give professionals or students as they integrate climate action into their careers, especially if they don't work in sustainability directly. And we did interview Ayana Bodhi, so you know her from Project Drawdown. I think she had some actionable insights here too, but I'm just curious your advice to people, whether they work in sustainability or not, how to kind of continue to integrate this into their work.
Yeah, I love the Project Drawdown's job function action guides and their mantra, every job is a climate job. I think kind of bringing the political influence focus is a bit harder because it feels somehow more controversial. It is more controversial, but I guess my call to action, my encouragement for everyone listening is thinking about what are the levers for action. When I joined my company's green team, the first thing that the team wanted to work on was getting rid of the styrofoam cups in the cafeteria. And we put so much energy into that. And it went not very far. And okay, maybe we had a little bit of success, but we put so much energy into something that was such small potatoes. Imagine we had put that energy and that creativity into rethinking how our company was engaging in climate lobbying. That is much higher leverage and is something it's harder to, let's say, incorporate directly into your scope of work if you're not working in government affairs already. But what you can do as an employee is ask good questions. Companies that care about their employees, and I hope the people listening to this are working for one of those companies, care what people have on their minds. I found out a lot and learned a lot about the challenges and the difficult trade-offs by bothering the government affairs representatives, by talking to our chief sustainability officer, by trying to figure out what is driving internal decisions and what is making it difficult to be a positive climate advocate. So there's always room to ask good questions, and it can be done in a way that is very pro-company. We are a leader in the climate space. I am proud of working for this company. How are we supporting this piece of climate legislation, or how are we making sure that the Inflation Reduction Act funding doesn't get cut? I think there's always a way to ask even the most politically sensitive questions in a way that hopefully get some interesting answers.
Yeah, I think that's a good answer. Especially I like the focus on thinking about what's big potatoes and not small potatoes. I think it's really easy to get wrapped up in kind of these small incremental changes. Not that those don't matter, but there's also a lot of room to really move the needle. So I think that's great advice. Amy, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time coming on the show.
It was an honor to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was great to have you.